I'm a drug addict and alcoholic. The preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contribution. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Thank you, Linda. It's with a great deal of, I feel particularly privileged and honored tonight to have the opportunity to introduce the speaker for tonight's meeting. Although I only met him last evening, I do feel as though I know him because of the testimony of many of my friends who have known him, who have heard him, or who have been touched by the generosity of his sharing his spiritual awakening and experience with those who suffer from the disease of addiction and alcoholism. Last night, we heard our chairperson, Malachy, attest to the influence that this man has had on him. I had the offer to listen to a tape of our speaker's message and chose not to listen so that I could keep both ears glued tonight. And it's with a great deal of pleasure and anticipation that I introduce to you Hillary from Cullman, Alabama.
Bonsoir, monsieur et madame. The only other French I know is voulez-vous bonbon? And you're supposed to say oui. And then I do know how to say ne manque pas. And the response to that is, je ne manquerai pas. I thought you were real Cajun, heaven's sake. I practiced all that. My name is Hillary Draper, and I'm an alcoholic. Good evening.
Hi.
Now, that tells you who I am and what I am. And when the two of us got up this morning, the who said to the what, we ain't going to take a drink today. And that's the way it's been all day long. But it didn't used to be that way. It didn't used to be that way. It used to be we'd get up and the who would say to the what, we ain't going to take a drink today. And the what would say to the who said so. And the who would say, I said so. And the what would say, just you wait and see. And the what would get drunk and the who would have the hangover. It is with a great deal of joy, personal satisfaction, that I come to you all this evening. I thank you for inviting me. In chapter 7, Working with Others, it says, life will take on a new meaning. To watch people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see a fellowship grow up about you, to have a host of friends, this is an experience you must not miss. We know you will not want to miss it. Frequent contact with newcomers and with each other is the bright spot of our lives. And to see your chairman for this great convention mount the podium and welcome us all last night, my heart overflowed with joy. It is true that I did give him a roof and did tell him to go to meetings. And he has a towering ego, just like I do. And we didn't hit it off. We didn't. But you know, the higher power has a way of putting people in the places he wants them put. And in that monastery, at the time Yo Chaman came with a dog, the dog had bit me. He did. He looks a great deal like your chairman, by the way. Have you ever seen his dog? There was another recovering alcoholic in our house, and his name was Malachy Shanahan, and he was an Irishman born in the old sod. And I would love to have been the one to have carried the message to Yo Chaman and to have watched him grow and to see, to have him as my pigeon. But I could tell it wasn't going to work that way. And he's correct. I said, on the top floor, there's another priest named Malachy. Go and see him. And it was Father Malachy Shanahan, who has gone to glory, who was your chairman's sponsor during those years. And it's just a great joy to see him so well and so recovering and so of use and so beloved. And so if you're new in AA, then stay long enough so that you can get some of that kind of joy. Well, let's get on with it. Another piece of the big book, you can't go wrong with that. For most normal folks, drinking means conviviality, companionship, and colorful imagination. It means release from care, boredom, and worry. It is joyous intimacy with friends and a feeling that life is good. Is that in the big book? Oh. But not so with us in those last days of heavy drinking. The old pleasures were gone. They were but memories. Never could we recapture the great moments of the past. There was an insistent yearning to enjoy life as we once did, and a heartbreaking obsession that some new miracle of control would enable us to do it. There was always one more attempt and one more failure. The less people tolerated us, the more we withdrew from society, from life itself. As we became subjects of King Alcohol, shivering denizens of his mad realm, the chilling vapor that is loneliness settled down. It thickened, ever becoming blacker. Some of us sought out salted places, hoping to find understanding, companionship, and approval. Momentarily we did. Then would come oblivion and the awful awakening to face the hideous four horsemen. Terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair. Unhappy drinkers who read this page will understand. And I'm supposed to stand up here and tell you what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. I'm supposed to stand up here and tell you the good times I had in drinking. I'm supposed to tell you when I came to face those four hideous horsemen, terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair. I'm supposed to tell you what I'm like today. Well, let's get on with it. I cannot remember when I took my first drink. It was always there. Period. I grew up in a Catholic household in Mobile, Alabama, and we did not think it was seriously morally wrong to drink in moderation. Make no mistake about it. We thought drunkenness was seriously moral wrong, just like the Baptists and some of the Methodists do. But it was always in our house. It was good times. It was company. And as children, we saw it. And we sipped it, just like the big people. A little wine in the bottom of a glass, cold water, just like the big people. Oh, I saw drunkenness in my family. I came from a great big family. I had six aunts and one adopted, and they had their own population explosion. They were the ladies in those years who were well corseted and looked like ice cream cones. Does anybody remember that? Oh, Lord, if they gave you a hug, that break your ribs from the whale bones. We had one uncle, call him Harry. He was kind of the leader of that pack whenever there was a wedding or a funeral. And Uncle Harry, in order to face all those relatives, would always take a few drinks to steady his nerves. The only thing is he'd get so steady he couldn't move. And the other uncles would carry him home. Now, you talk about having a good education and how to drink like a gentleman. It shouldn't have been me. I can remember my mother saying to us kids, now, you saw Uncle Harry last night. If you find out that drinking does that to you, then you just shouldn't drink. You notice all the rest of your uncles and aunts were perfect ladies and gentlemen, you see. So I really can't remember. I do remember, and I'm not sure I've told this before, I do remember that I discovered what alcohol could do for me when I was an altar boy. Now, I wouldn't tell this if I wasn't in Cajun country because I'd scandalize all the Baptists. But we were altar boys, you know. And in those years, you had a nice-sized cruet of wine. The wine we made in those years was homemade, and it was dreadful. Oh, my. And the priest would never take very much of it. And therefore, there'd be a lot left in the cruet. Well, we were instructed you weren't supposed to put it back in the bottle. It might sour all the rest of the wine. And it would certainly be a waste to pour it out. So what did an enterprising altar boy do? You didn't have to teach him. He drank it, of course. And you know what? I can remember, I was on an empty stomach. I can remember immediately levitating. It was two blocks home, and I never touched the pavements going home. Now, that's the truth. And as a kid, now, if my mother had any idea of that going on, and of course I didn't tell her, by the time I got home, my feet touched the ground again. But you see, I don't know whether I was born an alcoholic, whether I became an alcoholic. I just don't know. And I don't care today. I personally think that I was predisposed and that all you had to do was put in enough alcohol and we'd be off and running. I'm just not sure at all. I don't think that I got into any trouble from drinking until I joined a monastery. Isn't that edifying? My father was dead, God rest his soul. And my mother figured I needed some more men in my education. And at the tender age of 15, she sold me up the river to the tender mercies of the Benedictine monks, and I never got away. That was at Cullman, Alabama. I was a misfit from the way it go. I was not a good athlete. I'm just, period. As I told you, my father was dead. My grandfather, who was a marvelous man, was the male image in my life, and thank God for him, but he was not the kind to play ball. That's all there was to it. And my brother was already married, and therefore, yeah. But I was homesick, dreadfully homesick. But I got to know some of the local boys and their parents, and in those far-off halcyon days, the Cullman housewives, worthy of the name, knew how to squeeze that grape and make that German-type grape juice. And they made it out of strawberries. And if you all had never tasted Cullman County strawberry wine until you got into AA, it's just too late. You'll have to wait till you get to heaven. The most gorgeous color of red I ever saw in a wine. An aroma, you could smell it in the next block when they took a cork out of it. A kick like a Missouri mule. And you were in no trouble. You're in somebody's home with a glass of homemade wine, a piece of cake. Lovely. I loved everything about Cullman so much and the monks that I asked if I could join. And they said I could try. And in 1941, I entered the monastery as a novice. And I discovered that the monks were not about to be outdone by the housewives of Cullman. And they, too, knew how to squeeze that grape and make that German-type grape juice. And they made a little homebrew on the side. You talk about a revelation to the Gentiles. Now, I don't want you to think there's 50 drunk monks at Cullman. There's not. There used to be me and Malachy. Not that Malachy. A couple of others, but the rest of them are pretty normal people. And for your information, we don't manufacture anymore. But in those years, we did. We didn't drink every day. No. But on Sunday afternoons in the summertime, after Vespers for an hour, you know the German word, Gemütlichkeit? I don't know what the French word would be. You know, when you all come together and you have a great time, and they would have homemade wine and homebrew, pink lemonade for the panty waists, you know, and cheese and ham. Have a great time. But I discovered something about myself. I was always the first one there and the last one to leave. I was always figuring out when is the next time this is going to happen, you see, which isn't normal. You know, you don't worry about all that. And the reason I tell you that is because at Christmas time, as a novice, I couldn't have been but 16 years old. Yes, right, I was 16. I experienced my first blackout. You know what that is? You drink and drink and drink and drink, and finally the body, to save its own life, short-circuits some of the systems. You go unconscious, and you slide under the table, and there you stay until somebody takes you home, or the next morning you crawl out. That is not blacking out, that is passing out. And I have passed out too. But in blacking out, again, you drink and drink and drink, and the body, to save its own life, short-circuits some of the systems, and you go into, quote, temporary amnesia. You continue to function, quote, normally, quote, but you don't remember it. It's a strange phenomenon. And there I am at a Christmas party in the monastery, and the next morning, the last thing I remember was we were doing a skit on the night before Christmas, and that was about 9 o'clock, and that party didn't end up until 11:30 or so, but there's 2.5 hours that I don't remember a blessed thing. I don't remember anything. I slipped around to try to find out what happened, and apparently I did nothing. I stayed until the last shot was fired. I helped take the stuff back to the kitchen. I went to chapel, said the prayers, helped the old fathers to bed, went to bed. But there's 2.5 hours that I cannot account for. It bothered me. I didn't know whether I was going nuts or, you know, what had happened. Some clutch had slipped. Well, I think that I knew way back in the back of my mind that it had something to do with drinking, with alcohol. But you see, at that time, I loved everything about alcohol. I loved the way it tasted. I loved the way it smelled. I loved what it did for me. I was the type that didn't matter what it was, whatever I get my hands on, I'd take a great big mouthful and let it trickle down my goozle and then suck my teeth, you know? Now, if that bothers you, I'm sorry, but that's the way it was with me. Some people would say, I'd take a drink and, not me. Man, I loved it. I just, everything about it. And therefore, I was not about to admit that anything that I liked that much could do anything bad. But I had to reach a conclusion. What caused that phenomenon, that memory loss? I considered it with Aristotelian Thomistic philosophical principles. And I came to the conclusion that it was the cheese. Now, isn't that stupid? You know, everybody knows he's an alcoholic. Everybody knows he's got a problem with drinking. His wife knows it. His kids know it. His boss knows it. His friends know it. His dog knows it. But he doesn't know he's got a problem with alcohol. At least he won't admit it. And that was me. And the reason I take some time to tell you that story is because if you have experienced what I have just described, the blackout, that is almost a Satan sign that you got it, that you're a little bit pregnant. And there is no such thing as being a little bit pregnant. You either are or you aren't. And if you've experienced the blackout, then, and you're still at Al-Anon, you probably ought to move your letter over to the other room. That's true. Now, there I was. I wouldn't tell a soul about that. And after I got into Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't know what there was. I wasn't being honest. I wouldn't admit that I had blackouts. That was the first of many. I don't know why I had such a time admitting that I had blackouts. I just wouldn't admit it. No, I never had a blackout. Lying? Oh, my Lord. Well, there I am. I'm across... something's falling down. I'm across the invisible line between controlled and uncontrolled drinking. And it's a progressive disease. We know that. I didn't know what alcoholism is. I had no idea what it was. I knew what drunkenness was, but alcoholism, I didn't know that. I didn't know until I came to you all and read the big book that alcoholism is a disease. That it is a mental obsession coupled with a physical compulsion to drink. And that there's this craving which is set up that if you give the alcoholic the first drink, then that craving is going to set itself up, and sooner or later, he will be right back into the slough of despond, right back facing those four terrible horsemen. You see, I was young, hale and hearty. Lord have mercy. I brushed that off. I never told anybody about it. I kept right on going. And just as the book says, it's a progressive disease. This alcoholism will take everything you've got. You all know that. For a long time, we thought you had to lose everything. But it'll take everything. My sponsor early on said to me, I suppose he thought maybe I needed to hear that, that if I heard people talking about losing their wives, their families, their homes, their jobs, and none of that had happened to me, then go back and say, yet. That if you're an alcoholic and you continue to drink, then it will take everything you've got. As you will say, it took everything that meant anything to me. I don't see any other examples of alcoholism in my early life, except the pattern was established. My pattern of drinking was that I always drank as much as I could, as often as I could, whenever I could. I heard that lady last night say, when you took the cork out of the bottle, you threw it away. Well, of course, I thought everybody did that. You weren't going to need it if you were in my house. That's all there was to it. I never had the morning drink because either there was nothing left or I couldn't find it. And so I was spared that most of the time. There just wasn't any connection there. I was continued in my studies until I was ordained a priest in 47. That's a long time ago. And believe me, if Bishop Tulin had had any idea that Hillary Draper was a drunk monk, he would not have called me to order. The Catholic Church has enough trouble without ordaining drunks, believe me. And so at that time, I was still in what? Control? I'm not sure that's the word, but I was ordained. I was a teacher, and I was associate principal of a prep school. It was beginning to show, and I can remember my superior saying to me and other fathers, "Don't you think you're drinking a little bit too much?" And that would just send me through the ceiling. And I would even say to the abbot, "Don't talk to me about drinking. I'm teaching five classes a week. I'm running this school. Why don't you get on some of these people over here? They're not doing nothing. And if I am drinking too much, it's not hurting anybody but me," which was a lie. That's a lie. People say, "I need a few drinks to do my job." Huh? That means to cover up what you're not doing in your job. Great day in the morning. You can... Oh, well. What happened was we got a new boss in Coleman. And that was about 19... I can't remember the days. It was 1950-something. And the very first thing he did was to send me a letter because I was at the University of Alabama in pursuit of an elusive degree. And I opened up that letter and it said, "Go to Barberville, Kentucky. We need Father Timothy to come home and teach philosophy. You go up there and take that parish." I didn't think they could run that school without me. And there was no discussion. There was no consultation. Did I want to go? It was a letter and it said, "Go," period. And I went home to some of my cronies, Father Malachy being one of them, the dead one, and I showed it to Malachy, and I said to Malachy, "Where in God's holy name is Barberville, Kentucky?" He says, "You go to hell, turn left, and walk 3 miles. He was wrong. It was only 2. Oh, Lord, I went to Barberville, Kentucky. Great day in the morning, I'm telling you. And there, well, I'll tell you, this is a true story. The first morning I was there, Father Timothy and I had said Mass, and we went over next door to have breakfast. He said, "You take your meals in Aunt Sally Coon's house. That's your house she and Uncle Albert live in. And she belongs to the Lottie Moon Circle, but Uncle Albert's a Catholic, and he takes care of the church when you ride in the circuits. And whenever you're in town, they feed you." So we go to Aunt Sally Coon's. Hot September, oh Lord. No sign of air conditioner. Four-room miner's cabin. It was nice and clean. Aunt Sally looked like nothing so much as Mammy Yoakum in the funny papers. You remember with that pipe in her mouth? And she wasn't happy with the new priest. She had the old one broken in. We sat down at that kitchen table. Uncle Albert was sitting there. Father Timothy was there. I was over here. Uncle Albert's son, who was a state trooper, was sitting there. All he had on was a pair of shorts. His two boys, 16 and 17, similarly attired. Conversation was difficult. Sitting in front of me was a water tumbler, and nice and cold, and I picked it up and took two great big swallows. Well, you've seen the atomic bomb blast. I was absolutely breathless. The whole world shook. There was a trembling. The hair stood straight up on the back of my neck. I couldn't see. I'm not telling you a lie. I thought, dear God, what has happened here? And you know, I'm convinced today that if I had not been an alcoholic, I would have screamed bloody murder. But I don't. I just hang on tight till the tremors pass. That's the truth. And when I can see again, Uncle Albert's got a glass, Timothy's got one, the trooper's got one, the kids haven't got them. Well, when that breakfast was over, Timothy and me, we were stepping high over the weeds going back to the church. And I said, Timothy, in the Lord's holy name, what was in that water glass? He said, moonshine, 120 proof. I said, for breakfast? He says, anytime you can get it. I'm not breaking Timothy's anonymity because he's gone to glory, but he followed me a year later in this program. But wasn't that a glorious place to send a budding alcoholic? And I bloomed, you know. My alcoholism continued to progress. I say I didn't get in any trouble those years I was in Kentucky, but that's not true. I wasn't doing the job that I could have been doing if I wasn't drinking. Do you know what I'm talking about? She mentioned it again last night. You know, serious drinking takes time. You know, people say, let's go and have a couple of drinks. And they mean just that. But watch out when the man says, come on and let's do a little drinking. Doing a little drinking takes time. Lord have mercy. But at any rate, I was recalled to Coleman. I was the dean. And by this time, I'm hooked. I got to have it. I don't have to drink it every day, but I got to have it in the closet. I got to have it where I can look at it. You know, in case of snake bite, or I want to celebrate Freedom Fighters Day. It's got to be there. I got to shake it and look at the frog eyes. I got to read the labels on it. And that's not normal drinking. And again, the pattern is, once I start, for whatever reason, I don't stop until I'm too sick to drink and there's nothing left to drink. Once again, these terrible personality clashes are coming up with the boss. I get another geographical cure removal. This time, I'm sent to the Delta of the Mississippi. But if you all don't know the Delta of the Mississippi, and you think you know the South, you don't know a thing about the South. The Delta's not in Southwest Louisiana. It starts in the lobby of the Peabody Hotel in Memphis, Tennessee. And it goes downriver 40 miles on the Mississippi side, 20 miles on the Arkansas side, and you come to Yazoo City. And those folks do not know the Civil War was lost. They don't know it was fought and couldn't care less. You talk about drinking as a way of life. Ooh, Lord have mercy. And did I fall right in with it? I'm telling you. I thought I had come to heaven. You know, I'm not going to tell you how hard it was for a monk in the monastery to get whiskey. That's one of those tales that you just have to, I'm not going to tell you. That's all you say. It's none of your business. But here I had gone to Mississippi, and I could pick up the phone and say, Mamie, and she'd say, be right there, Father. Now, Father Malachy always told me that when I told that story, I should be sure that you knew that Mamie was the bootlegger. You're a little slow tonight. Honestly, Mamie would come, take out the dead soldiers, put in new recruits, and send you a bill at the end of the month. Had it made in the shade. Except, just like the big book says, I was beginning to come apart. I was beginning to come apart spiritually and mentally and emotionally and physically. Yes, I was a priest, and here I was. I couldn't tell morning from night. This is just at the time when we were deciding we could have Mass in the evening. That it wasn't going to be a breakfast service, it'd be a supper service. And good Bishop Giroux had said to the pastors, whatever you think is good for the parish, do. You think Mass in the morning is fine, do. You think Mass in the... So we had Mass sometimes 7 a.m., sometimes 7 p.m. Well, in the fall especially, I could never tell whether it was 7 a.m. or 7 p.m. when I'd get up. And the only thing I could do is I'd go over to church and look very pious with my prayer book and sit there. And if anybody came for Mass, I knew it was time for Mass. If they didn't, I went home and had another drink. You know, what an existence. Dear God in heaven. People were beginning to talk ugly about you. Well, we had a new boss at Coleman, a damn Yankee from Michigan. He didn't know a thing. Not a thing. But he turned out to save my life. And today I honor and reverence him more than any other monk that I know. He came down from Minnesota. And there I was, a pastor over there in the Delta. And I got word that he was coming to see me, this new boss that I hadn't met. And I thought, oh, Lord, who's been snitching? These people, you know, they're always talking. But he came with his aide-de-camp. He was on his way to Dallas, I think. Spent the night with me, and we had antipasta, we had pasta, we had a dinner, we had three kinds of wine, we had after-dinner drinks, and I didn't touch a thing, nothing. Well, the evening passed nicely, and he went to bed, and I said to his chauffeur, his secretary, I said, what does the boss want over here? He said, well, didn't he talk to you? I said, well, no more than you heard. Oh, he said, well, the board of trustees has nominated you 7th president of the college. And he's decided that he should come over here and interview you before he accepted or rejected the nomination. And he told me tonight, as he was giving me his notes, that he was well satisfied with the interview and he was going to accept the nomination. And I got the nomination as president of the college. Now, you know the second step in this program? Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Anybody with any sanity who had my track record up to that time, when offered the job as president of the college, would have said, no, thank you. There's too much responsibility in that. I'm too far gone in alcoholism. No, I cannot take that job. I'm offered the job, and what does the towering ego of the alcoholic say? Of course I'll take that job. You don't think they'd be offering to a drunk? That'll show these people around here whether or not I got a drinking problem. And they gave me a glorious send-off. I know today they were saying, thank God he's gone. But again, because of a higher power and this program, I've been able to make amends over there and to come back. And so I became president of the college. Oh, Lord have mercy. And I'd like to say that if you want to get into a job where drinking can be a way of life, become president of a college. You know? It's just there up here. You've got a lot of entertaining to do, and you've got to relax, and oh, Lord. So I will say in the next 3 years that everything that hadn't already happened to me that happens to drunks happened. Okay, that's right. No? I remember losing the automobile and then saying, it's not your automobile. It belongs to the church. Where did you put the car? I don't know where I put the car. Did you leave it in Memphis? Did you leave it in Birmingham? Where? We want the car. I don't know where the car is. Oh, it's funny now. It wasn't funny then. I haven't lost a car since I've been in AA. Oh, merciful heavens. That leaves me. And then, you know, don't I look lovely? Don't I clean up good? Would you believe that I've been in jail in the drunk tank? I woke up at 3 o'clock regularly. You know, and these four terrible horsemen would be there. But this one time I woke up at 3 o'clock and I thought, where am I? And when I got my eyes open, I was sleeping on a bed with no mattress, just springs and no pillow. And when I got my eyes fully open, there was bars at the window. And I thought, where am I? And I got up and I looked out that window. I thought, I'm in jail. How did I get here? What happened? You know, I resented the people that built that jail. Because the way they built it, when you looked out of that window, I could not tell if I was in Mobile, New Orleans, Birmingham, Nashville, Memphis, or Rome, Italy. There's no way I could, all I could see was a brick wall. Oh, Lord. I tell you that again because always in these small towns, Homer's a big town, so you wouldn't have it, but maybe Thibodex would have it. We ended up there when we were trying to get to Homer this yesterday afternoon. It's up the road a while. Thibodeaux. I bet they got one. In those little towns in the South, there's always somebody who is Mr. or Mrs. Catholic Church. And when anything happens concerning Catholics, they get called in to deal with it. And so a man was called up that night, and he was told, Mr. Frank, we got a Catholic priest in the jail down here tonight, drunk and disorderly. And Mr. Frank says, who is it? And they said, well, his driver's license says Hillary Draper from Coleman. What do you want to do with him? Mr. Frank says, just leave him there. I'll get him in the morning. You know, that fits some of the stuff we heard in another talk of business, didn't it? And I want to tell you that because in the morning when they took me down to the sergeant's desk, I want you to know who Mr. Frank was. I would much rather have seen the Pope than to have seen Mr. Frank. Because it just so happened that Mr. Frank was the chairman of the board of governors of the college of which I was president. Coincidence? Oh, Lord have mercy. I looked at Frank and I knew where I was instantly. And he fished me out of the tank and took me over to the local priest. But he said to me, Father Hillary, this is terrible. He says, we've got to do something. I said, oh, Frank, I just had too much cheese at the country club last night. And you know what con artists we are? He should have told my boss, he should have racked me up. But no, I got away with it. I still had a ways to run. But it was coming close to the end. It was about a year later when I was to give a report, the State of the Union message, to all the important people in the college, to the Board of Trustees, the Board of Governors, all the monks, all the lay professors, the Student Government Association, about 200 people for supper. And the last thing I remember that day, it was 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I was taking one more drink to steady my nerves. And that's the truth. And I went into a blackout, and I do not remember one thing from 4 o'clock in the afternoon till the next morning at 6. And I made that speech. And when I tell you that, I can begin to sweat and shake. Because I can have some idea of what it must have been like for those splendid people to watch, to listen to the obviously drunken priest, president of the college, stagger through that report. I don't remember. I don't know whether I blocked it out on papers. I just don't know. The next morning, I noticed the atmosphere was a little cool on the campus. Within a few days, I was in the boss's office, the chancellor of the abbot's office, throwing dust. You know how we are. And he listened to me for a while. He said, sit down. I want to tell you something. And I sat down. And he read me the Riot Act in 5 or 6 gorgeous Technicolor scenes. He didn't know the word alcoholism. He told me that I was a disgrace to my own good family name, that I had dragged the name of the priesthood through the mud of drunkenness, that I had done my best to tear down the good reputation of that college, that I had scandalized and outraged all of the monks and could possibly never repair the damage done to the lay people, and that I was through, period, that I was to resign as president of the college. Still bold, brassy, nasty. I say to him, when is it effective? In June? You see, this was December. He looked at me with all the compassion in his heart, and he said, no, it's effective right now. We had a board of trustees meeting. There's one thing on the agenda, was your resignation. Sign here. And he said to me, I wish you'd go somewheres and get some help with your drinking problem. But you cannot stay here. We've had all of you we intend to put up with. If you will not go anywheres and get some help, then you can get out of here. I'll help you get a job. You're a good teacher, but you cannot stay here. He said, what do you want to do? Talk about confrontation. I've always been a prepared coward. And so I told him I would go anywhere to do anything I could for my drinking problem. And so my sobriety date is January the 14th, 1968. And that was the day I landed in upper Minnesota at a place called Hazelden with the temperature 20 degrees below zero and a wind chill factor that took it down to 50. I'm telling you, I've never been so cold in all of my life. And there I was in an asylum. Oh, Lord. And those far-off days, their program was a great program. They insisted that you learn the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and that you take, do, perform, get through steps 1, 2, 5. And for the smart alcoholic, they did it in 3 weeks. But the first morning I was there, I went down, I was taken down to see the counselor, and I was dressed up nicely in my black dickie and my Roman collar, and the first thing that man said to me was, now, Father Hillary, it's the last time we'll call you Father, because you ain't nothing but a goddamn drunk. You talk about being outraged. I was going to call up the boss and say, you know you sent me up here with blasphemers and profaners? He says, take off that Roman collar, take off that black dickie. You got no right to wear it. You're not a priest in good standing. We will not call you. Do you see the hypocrisy? Do you see the towering ego? Locked up in an asylum, like butter would melt in my mouth. And he says, and don't plan on 3 weeks for this program. I said, well, of course not. I reckon I'll get it in two. He says, oh, no, no. We find for doctors, lawyers, Indian chiefs, embalmers, morticians, priests, professors, high school teachers. It takes 3 and 4 times as long to get this simple program. And I said, why? They said, because you all keep up such a dreadful facade. It takes a long time to get behind that and find out where the real Hillary lives. And they were right. They were I was one of the slowest learners they ever had. I just hated it. I hated everything about it. They gave me the big book. That's not true. They sold it to me. And they said, read it. And the first thing I did was to look inside to see if it had an imprimatur and if it was approved by a Catholic bishop. As you well know, it isn't. And I said, uh-huh. I bet you it's printed in Nashville by the Baptists. And I'm not going to be brainwashed. And I would not read the big book. Can you imagine the stupidity? And me, you know, a college professor, I wouldn't read it. No. They sold me the little 24-hour-a-day book. You know that. That's not imprimatur. That doesn't have a bishop. I loved it. I read it assiduously, but I would not read that big book. Well, all they did, they had 3 meetings a day, one in the morning, one in the afternoon, one at night, where they took you over one of the steps in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so by osmosis, since I get through there at least 12 weeks, that means I got through it 4 times. Went through the whole process 4 times. Something went through by osmosis. It became apparent to my cunning alcoholic brain that if I did not take, do, somehow or another get through steps 1 to 5, I was going to be there till Gabriel blew his horn. And I decided I didn't want to stay that long. So one night, I sat up and I read the first 164 pages of the big... I didn't go to bed, I read them. I couldn't wait for breakfast. After breakfast, I shut down to that counselor's office. He says, what do you want? I says, I've got step 1. My life is unmanageable. I'm powerless over alcohol. He says, you ain't got nothing. I said, I do. My life is powerless over alcohol. My life is unmanageable. He said, you are loaded with resentments. I said, I don't resent anybody. Now, there's a kind of blindness with this disease. He was right. I resented God. I resented the Pope. I resented the Bishop. I particularly resented the Abbot. And boy, I really hated the monks. I was just loaded with resentment. He was absolutely correct. But what happened to really make me see what was going on was there was a small Christian brother in treatment. Oh, he wouldn't come up to my shoulder. And he was very incommunicative. He didn't have much to say to us at all. One Sunday afternoon, a knock at my door in the asylum, and it opened up, and here was this little creature. And he said, "Can I come in?" I said, "Yes." And he came in, sheepish, and I said, "What can I do for you?" He said, "Well, this is my second time through. I was here, and I got out, and I went home, and I got drunk that same night, and the next morning they put me back in the asylum." And he said, "The counselors tell me that my ego is so low that I could walk through a door when it was closed, just go under it. And they said that at their weekly meetings, they have concluded that you are so far up on cloud nine that if they can't get you down and I can't get up, that neither one of us will ever make the program. And so they've told me to come see you to see if I can get you down and you can get me up." Now, I thought, that is the dumbest thing I have ever heard. So I said to him, "Did they tell you how to do it?" He says, "No." I said, "Well, what are we supposed to do?" He says, "I don't know." I said, "Well, sit down." I said, "What's your name?" He said, "My name is Brother Joel." I said, "Well, you know, I'm Father Hillary." He said, "Yes." I said, "What kind of brother are you?" He said, "I'm a Christian brother. We taught down in Memphis, and right now I'm over at Winona." He said, "What kind of priest are you?" I said, "I'm Benedictine from Alabama." I said, "You in Winona? What you got in Winona?" He said, "We got a college." He said, "What y'all got in Alabama?" I said, "We got a college." I said, "What were you in a college?" He said, "I was the president." He said, "What were you?" I said, "I was the president." You know, you talk about getting with the winners. You talk about, read the big book when it says trying to carry the message. Get the right person to carry that message. And here came this little creature. His college was three times as big as mine. He had two PhDs, and one of them in Greek. And I thought I was the most important drunk that ever came down the pike. Well, let me tell you that we both began to get better from that day because we could lean on one another. And all of a sudden, I wasn't the worst thing that ever happened. And all of a sudden, he wasn't. To make you the great story, we both recovered. Thanks be to God. He was never elected president of the college again. He was elected the religious superior and appointed the president. He celebrated his golden jubilee as a religious, and he invited me to come up and preach for the occasion. Now, that time, things had gotten well with me, and I had been elected the abbot, and I said I would go if I had to walk. And I went up with all my finery and regalia, my top hat and gold walking stick and the red ribbons and the lace. And some people said I overflowed the pulpit. But after dinner, all the brothers knew the story, you know, where we came from. But there were several bishops there, and one bishop said, "How is it that Brother Joel knows the abbot of Alabama so well to have him come all the way up here for his jubilee?" And I looked at Joel, and Joel looked at me, and I said, "Well, Bishop, ain't neither one of us going to tell you." But it was a glorious success story. Eventually, I got out of the treatment center, and I went back to Coleman. I didn't want to go back to Coleman. I just did not want to go face the music. And they said, "You had to." So I had to go back, not as president, but to pick up the pieces. And I went back, and the boss man, I think they were not happy that I had come back. I think they figured they were rid of me and they could send me over to Louisiana or Texas or Arkansas. You know, go west, young man, go west. And AA said, "You go back to the scene of the crime and you pick up the pieces." And the boss man said, "Well, what are you going to do?" I said, "Well, I don't know." He said, "Well, you've got the degrees. Go on over and ask him if you can teach school." I'd been the president of that damned place. And I had to go over and file an application to be a guest lecturer, which was the lowest thing on the totem pole. And the man I had to apply to, I had taken out of the woods of North Alabama and gotten him educated, and he was the head of the department. And he wrote me a letter and said that I could take these two classes as long as I could stay sober. You talk about resentment? I almost got drunk at him. But I didn't, and that was the beginning. I wish I could tell you that as soon as I got back to Coleman, I started going to AA. I didn't. And therefore, I sometimes feel like a hypocrite when I'm dealing with people. I say, you got to go to the... Thank you. Hello. Are you still there? There was a priest there, Father Luke, and he used to say to me, aren't you supposed to be going to some kind of meetings? I said, yeah, but they don't have them in Coleman. Well, he said, you can go to Decatur. That's only 30 miles. I said, well, I don't need to. I read the big book. I share my experience so I can help with people I think are doing some good. Notice the classical two-stepper. And I stayed a loner from September until the next January. And I was certainly going to get back in that bottle pretty soon. But that priest was still looking out for me, non-alcoholic. Came to me one day, he says, here, for your information, AA is alive and well in Coleman. Here's the phone number. Call him. Every day for 3 days, he said, did you call? I said, yes, but they don't answer. And then he said, when do you call? I said, midnight. I'm not making that up. He said, call now. And I did. And I got my first sponsor, who still is one of my sponsors, Juby. And I said, Mr. G, this is Father Hillary out at the college. I'm an alcoholic, and I need to go to a meeting. I don't think he knew what had gone on. But there was this long pause on the telephone. And the first thing Juby ever said to me over the phone was, Father, are you drunk now? You know, the realism of the program. Don't talk to me about anything else. Find out whether he's drunk. And I said, no, I'm not drunk. He says, well, don't take a drink today. It so happens we have a meeting tonight at 8 o'clock. I'll be along at 7:30 to pick you up. I said, fine, Mr. G, but don't come to the front door of the college. I will meet you down on the road to the cemetery in the dark of the moon under the pine trees. I'm not making that up. And Malachy's been to Coleman, and he knows the road to the cemetery in the pine trees in the dark of the moon where Juby came to take me to my first AA meeting. I walked up those steps, and you should have seen the club room. Oh, my Lord in heaven. It was about as big as that machine over there, that little alcove over there, up the top of the steps over the pool room. And the plaster was coming down off the ceiling. The wallpaper was rolling down. One naked light bulb hanging down. There was a hole in the floor where they swept the date down to the man below. It was a sofa with the springs coming out, about 10 people in there. And they all looked like foot-washing Baptists, a Church of Christ to me. And I thought, oh, my Lord, what have I gotten into now? Now, I don't want you all to feel bad about that. That's the way I was. It's not that way today. If you're an alcoholic, I don't care if you're a snake charmer. If you want what we got, then come on in. You belong with us. We're glad to have you. But then I'm standing outside the door, the glass on the door. I'm looking in there. Juby's disappeared. I can't find him. If I could, I'd have him take me home. I'm looking in there, you know, and looking and looking. And while I'm standing there, a lady comes, and she takes me by the arm. I turned around, and here's this gorgeous woman. I knew her as a splendid Catholic matron from up in Decatur. I had worked in church affairs with her any number of times. I did not know she was an alcoholic. And she said, hello, Father Hillary. And I said, why, Rosemary. She said, yes, Rosemary. She said, come on in. You need what we've got. Come on in and sit down and have a cup of coffee. You're going to be all right. And she put her arm through mine, and she mesmerized me right through the doors of Coleman Alcoholics Anonymous. And I did not know for 2 years that she was a shill. That was all a put-up job. That after I called Juby, he had called Decatur and said, Rosemary, you come on down to the meeting in Coleman tonight. She said, I can't. I'm chairing my meeting here. He said, I don't care what you're doing. I got a Catholic priest coming in here tonight. I don't know a damn thing about Catholics, much less priests. You're a Catholic, and you get down here and help me with this priest. And when the poor, drunken, stupid Catholic priest is trying to get through the doors of AA, There's Rosemary holding out the hand of Alcoholics Anonymous. I shudder to think in my arrogance and pride what might have happened to me if Rosemary hadn't been there that night. But she was there. Rosemary's still in the program. That's 20 years and more ago. She's not as active as she was then. But I'll tell you, I'll walk a long, long way for Rosemary. And that was the beginning. That was the beginning of the new life. That was the beginning of the recovering. And it has been glorious ever since. I know people that say, watch out for the pink cloud. You know, I've been on a pink cloud for 20 years, and I see no reason to come down. I'm sorry. My feet are firmly planted on the earth, but my head is still in the pink cloud. Oh, Lord. So many great things have happened to me. I'll be done in another 6 minutes. That'll be an hour for me. I mean, you all had something that you did before, so that didn't count. But so many great things have happened. I've made all the mistakes that you can possibly make in this program. I remember asking in a closed meeting, why am I an alcoholic? Why am I, with my splendid background, my aristocratic background, if the truth were known, as degenerate Southern aristocracy, with my tremendous education, university degrees, ordination of the priesthood, a theologian, at least of the second water, what in the hell am I doing an alcoholic? I thought, that'll get them. And there was this great silence that comes over the group. You know it, when everybody knows the answer and they're waiting to see who's going to zap the fool. And Juby says, oh, hell's all the hero. It don't make no difference how the jackass got into the ditch. Just get him out. Isn't that glorious wisdom, you know? And then I got theological on him. This was another time. I thought, I'll fix him. I said, now I want to know something else. This wasn't the same night. There wasn't, you know, one fool tonight's enough. But I said, I want to know this. I want to know this. Now, for the past 3 years, I've been sober. I don't think I've been sober. I was dry. And I say, if I don't manage my own life, now that I'm sober, who's going to manage it? I thought, that'll get him. Again, that silence. And Juby says, well, Father, you know, step three said, made a decision to turn our wills and our lives over to the care of God. And step 11 said, sought through prayer and meditation. I said, shut up. Here I am, a trained theologian, and I have to go to the drunks to learn theology. You know, one time I knew that God was supposed to be running my life, but I forgot that. And AA gave it back to me. AA gave it back to me. So many great and good things have happened. I was blessed with marvelous sponsors. Johnny knew Tom Pettis. Tom Pettis was the meanest man that God ever put breath into. Oh, my Lord. He was a district attorney, prosecuting attorney. He took one look at me and decided that I needed him. And he grabbed onto me like a bulldog and would not turn loose. Oh, Lord, I'm grateful, grateful for him to this very day. And what a tremendous man he was. So I've had marvelous sponsors in this program, and I'm grateful for that. I still have good sponsors. Hi, Lord, quickly now, tell the story and get on with it. 1972... the boss resigned, the monks locked themselves up, prayed, made the vows to be honest, elect a new man. What right have I got to think that I would be even considered? And yet, when the bells rang to announce the election, and all the young monks come because they don't get to vote, who is the new abbot of St. Bernard? And the word goes out, the seventh abbot of St. Bernard is Hilary Draper. And all the young monks that run up and down the monastery halls shouting all the way with AA. You know, sometimes I just get scared to death. In May, the Archbishop of Mobile had to be out of town. He called me up and he said, Abbott, would you please come over and take the Mary's Day celebration in the cathedral? And I said, Archbishop, I'd be delighted. He said, you'd be chilling, use the crozier. You know, that's the gold stick. And I said, Archbishop, I'm not entitled to use the crozier in the cathedral. The mitre, yes. He said, I know that, and you know that, but the people don't know that. And they expect to see the crozier. Use the crozier. So here I get over there, and I'm in the sacristy and getting all ready, and the Master of Ceremonies comes up, and he says, Abbot, the Archbishop said before he left to tell you to be sure to use the throne. I said, James, you know I'm not entitled to use the throne. He said, the Archbishop said you would say that. And he said to tell you that he knows that, and you know that, but the people don't know that. And they expect to see you on the throne. I said, well, I'm not so worried about that. But in the crypt of this cathedral, there is buried another archbishop. And when he finds out I'm on his throne, he's liable to come right out of that crypt. And sure enough, we were in the services. The cathedral was full. You know, I tell you those things because at times I sit there and I think, dear God, how in the heaven's name did I get here? And my sponsor, Tom Pettis, used to say, Father Hilary, you must tell that. You must tell those kinds of things. Because what it says to the alcoholic is that you get in AA and you stay in AA and there is no place that you can't go. I have to tell you, that afternoon when I was on the Archbishop throne all dressed up, there was a terrible thunder and lightning storm. And I declare it was the old archbishop in the tomb underneath me. Be that as it may. Last story. Because of this program, I had the opportunity of going and making a trip to the Holy Land, walking in the footsteps of Jesus. It would never have become possible. It was a VIP tour with a bunch of abbots and bishops, important people, you know. And we went everywheres in the Holy Land. And everywheres I went, all I could do was sit down and weep. And they would say to me, Abbot, what's the matter with you? Why are you crying? And I would say, just get out of the way. I don't know. I didn't tell them this. I didn't know whether I was weeping from the gift of tears, whether I was weeping for amends that I felt I needed to make. I don't know. But I said to them, AA told me that when I wanted to cry, I could cry. Now just get out of the way. I'm crying. Period. But of all the places we went, the tomb of Christ, Gethsemane, every place we went, the place that struck me the most was Bethany, the home of Martha and Mary and Lazarus. You remember the story. They seemed to have been great friends of the Lord's. And when things were really pressing in on him, he'd go down and spend a weekend with them. Lazarus is sick. The Lord's preaching over in Galilee. The apostles get the word. Mary has sent the word to him, and they say, Lazarus, your friend is sick. He says, well, it's all right. He doesn't go. Now, Martha has been expecting the Lord to come do something. He's been this wonder worker, and he's eaten them out of house and home. Where is he? And no, he doesn't get there, and Lazarus dies. And not only that, Lazarus is buried, and no sign of Jesus. You know, that's the kind of friend you really want, see. And the Lord says that Lazarus is asleep. And the apostles say, well, if he's asleep, he'll do well. The Lord says, no, he's dead. And so they say, let us go. And they go. Well, Martha has been eyeballing the road. And she sees him coming down the road. And she prances out in her Al-Anon personality. And she faces the dear Lord. And she says with all the sarcasm in her voice that she can muster, Lord, if thou hadst been here, my brother had not died. That Martha, she doesn't know she's facing omnipotence, almighty power. But fortunately, she's facing infinite love and mercy. And the Lord looks at her and he says, Martha, thy brother will rise again. And all of a sudden, Martha is a real Al-Anon. And she says, yes, Lord, I know, at the last day. And he goes in to see the relatives, and then he says, let's go out and see the cemetery, see the grave. They go out, and he says, roll the stone away from the door of the tomb. And Martha says, he's been in there 4 days. By this time, he stinks. Ladies and gentlemen, I submit that I certainly did stink, but I surely do know what Lazarus felt like when he walked out of that tomb. Thank you so much.